Morning, good to see you. Welcome to people who are joining Sashin for the weekend and joining for the talk and joining all the ways that we're joining. So if you haven't been here, we've been talking a bit about Zen teacher, Japanese Zen pioneer, Keizan Jokin is considered the second founder of Soto Zen after Dogen. He was born just after Dogen died, but he studied with all four of Dogen's principal disciples and ended up going with one of those disciples, a priest named Jiken, to a temple that was established nearby, Eheiji, and then he went on to establish his own temples. And he was an interesting fella. We've been learning about him. Really cared about women practitioners and paid attention to his heart and his dreams and the alignment of the stars before he did anything. And he started six temples himself, and then his disciples started lots of temples. So, you know, when Dogen died, it was a pretty small operation. Soto Zen was Eheiji, and after Keizan and his disciples, it began to become a thing. So here's a little more about Keizan's mystical practice. It's important for us to know about this kind of stuff, regardless of how you feel about mystical stuff. But just, it's good to have a little counterweight to the prevailing idea that we bring and sort of have floating around us, that our practice is sort of a scientific, calming, neuro-healing process only. And it is all those things, I think. But there's more going on. So here's a little bit about Keizan. This is from William Bodiford's wonderful book, Soto Zen in Medieval Japan. So if you want to catch up with all these characters, this is a great book to do it. I think it was his PhD thesis turned into a book. A few paragraphs from the Keizan chapter. Keizan's faith in the mystical powers of spirits and of divination was rooted in his own powers of shamanic communication. Keizan repeatedly conjured visions and spoke to spirits in his mystical dreams. Shamanistic elements are not unusual in meditative traditions such as Zen. Dogen, for instance, had met Chinese Chan masters who relied on dreams to see the future. Yet Keizan relied on these visions to guide every step of his career. According to Keizan's own accounts, he selected the location for the abbot's building at Yokoji, his main monastery, based on the approval of a visiting Rakan, which is an arhat, enlightened being, visiting enlightened being. And he enshrined an image of Bishamon after perceiving a promise of protection in a dream. And he decided to convert Sojiji to a Zen temple only after Kanon appeared in a vision and requested that he do so. When someone questioned the proper geomancy of the mausoleum at Goroho, Keizan wrote that he thought to himself, "At this monastery, from the very beginning, in all matters, I've relied on the interpretation of my dreams," and then decided that his next vision would determine the location of the mausoleum, and it did. Keizan's dream sequences illustrate how in medieval Japan, the religious activity of a person reflects the sacredness of his or her surroundings. Even as this same sanctified environment authenticated one's religious quest, it's like a two-way relationship between the practitioner and the place. For Keizan, Zen enlightenment entailed not just an ineffable insight into religious truth, but also involved astral communication with spirit guides who establish the Buddhist path and guard over it. In one remarkable dream sequence, for example, Keizan described how he journeyed into other realms where the three Buddhas of the past, present, and future, Vipassana, Shakyamuni, and Maitreya, one by one, confirmed his enlightenment. What a far out dream that would be. In other dream episodes, the native Japanese spirits of this world, kami, such as Hachiman, Inari, etc., all praise his Zen teachings and promise the future prosperity of Yokoji Temple. Visions of this type were especially important in medieval Japan, not just to confirm the veracity of religious experience, but as sources of political and sectarian authority. Keizan's ability to contact the spirits in order to learn their hidden will represents one pulse in a long Japanese tradition of cultic worship based on shamanistic rites of possession and oracular activities, oracles, shamans. In ancient Japan, women seem to have monopolized the role of shamanistic diviner to a great extent, evidently because their femininity or procreative abilities gave them access to the powers of the unseen world. But as Buddhism gained popularity, religious function previously associated with female shamans also came to be performed by male Buddhist ascetics who sojourned in secluded mountains for ritual meditation. Mountain priests, Yamabushi, in particular, were seen as being imbued with charismatic powers because the Japanese regarded the lofty peaks where they trained as meeting grounds between humans and non-human supernatural powers. Keizan's talent for dreaming suggests a different approach to charismatic religious power. Keizan was a Zen monk, trained to sit for hours in silent meditation. He had no need for journeys into the mountains. Instead of going to the mountains to meet spirits and divinities, Keizan conjured visions and recorded his dreams to demonstrate that these special beings were naturally drawn to Yokoji. The promises of Keizan's best visions, however, were not fulfilled. And then you have to read the next chapter to find out what that's about. Cliffhanger in an academic book. So, far out stuff. And his dream journals, some of them survive. And if you really get curious, I could send you a PDF with excerpts from his dream journals and astrological adventures. So if we do indeed find ourselves a new place, we have to consider whether to consult the stars and our dreams and not just have committee meetings. Probably be good. So like I was saying, you know, I don't know what you make of all that kind of stuff. I bet we have a diversity of opinion. And since the dominant theme in our culture is Western materialism and scientificism, which I love too, I bet you those of us who really love the mystical stuff probably like keep it a little bit zipped, you know. So full permission, you know. Let it out. We can be shamans and spiritualists as well as Zen practitioners for sure. Because who knows, you know. I mean, I grew up, like many of us, I think I grew up in a very scientific kind of framework. In my case, four of my immediate family have PhDs in the hard sciences. I realized I added them up. My young cousin added a fourth not too many years ago. So I was surrounded with that view. We never went to church or talked about spirits, except for my one grandmother, my famous grandmother, Fran, who would go see healers and see visions. So I would hear her talking to my mom about that around the kitchen table while my dad was at work banging atoms together. And understanding that nature of the universe. So I don't know if I believe, you know, like believe in spirits, in the spirit world. But I sure have had experiences that I don't really know how to explain otherwise, you know. Do they need to be explained, you know? That's another question. And it's also helpful that Zen, while it's full of words, Zen also throws a little caution around trying to explain everything, right? Trying to reduce the ineffable to words. And yet, words are what we got. So here's the next paragraph of Keizan's meditation manual that we've been studying, called Zazen Yojinki. The attachments of the five desires all arise from ignorance. Ignorance is due to a lack of clarity about the self. And Zazen illuminates the self. For example, although the five desires may be removed, if ignorance is not yet removed, that is not yet the attainment of Buddha. If you want to remove ignorance, the diligent practice of Zazen is the key. An ancient said, if distraction is removed, tranquility arises, and if tranquility arises, wisdom is attained. And if wisdom is attained, the truth is clearly seen. Distraction is removed, tranquility arises, and if tranquility arises, wisdom is attained. And if wisdom is attained, the truth is clearly seen. If you want to remove distractions, you must be free from thoughts of good and evil. Renounce involvement in karmic relations. The most important concern is the mind be free from thinking and the body free from acting. When distracting relations are ended, mental disturbances are subdued. And when mental disturbances are subdued, the unchanging body is manifest. And you continually realize its clarity as neither extinction nor commotion. Maybe neither arising nor ceasing. It's better at the end there. So that's pretty clear. Lots of step-by-step-by-step scientific-sounding truths here from our mystical friend. So attachment to the five desires, but the root is ignorance. And so easily we spin off, right, and don't access this little chain that he's describing, and I'm not sure whom he's quoting. Sometimes then people quote people that they make up too. But removing distraction, tranquility, tranquility to wisdom, wisdom to truth. So we've been sitting here for some while. Also sitting here in the middle of our lives, which I'm going to explore a little more later in the talk, which I think is kind of fabulous, actually. More fabulous than I would have thought. But so easily we lose track of tranquility, right? He says in there, be free of thoughts. Especially free of thoughts of good and evil. Like it, don't like it. And renounce involvement in karmic relations. And what are karmic relations? Like all relations are karmic relations, right? Everything where one thing influences another is a karmic relation. So back to stopping, right? But the interesting thing there is this beginning about the five desires, which I assume are attached to the five senses, right? Because anything you desire, you can see, feel, hear, touch. And if we, I suppose, be thorough, we would add sense number six, which is the mind that does the thinking, because probably that's the biggest desire, right? The things we think about. Phil is full of desire and aversion that has very little to do with the actual five senses, you know. So I'm not sure why he didn't add that. So he says, yeah, you want to be free of all that. And you can easily be, you can be free of that, all that through clarity about the self. And Zazen illuminates the self, illuminates, it lights up, makes clear. But then in the very next sentence he says, well, that might not actually be enough. Although the five desires may be removed, if you manage that, you know, freedom from desire, if ignorance is not yet removed, then you're not there yet. You've not yet attained Buddha. So ignorance is the root problem, you know, in Buddhism. So it always comes back to ignorance. And understanding what they mean by ignorance is not a lack of information, which is how we tend to use ignorance on the schoolyard, right? Which is basically where we formed most of our views, you know. You're so ignorant. You know? Yo mama. I remember our roots, you know. But in Buddhism, ignorance, you know, is points to misunderstanding. Not a lack of information, but like the wrong information. Or maybe believing that there is information where it's not that kind of thing at all. It's not about information. There are suffering in this framework. This is especially the Mahayana Buddhist framework, but it's present in the earlier Buddhisms, like Chris was reading from. But in this framework, our suffering is not because something's wrong, which is a powerful thought. Our suffering is not because something's wrong. It's not because something's wrong with us. It's not because something's wrong with the world. Our suffering, according to this framework, is because we don't see it clearly. We misunderstand who we are, how we work. We misunderstand reality and how it all works. We're seeing it all through this tremendous distortion, this field of distortion. And the biggest influence that's usually described in this field of distortion that messes us up and makes us suffer is grasping. Right, is grasping, or sometimes they say thirst, tanha, which is basically a thirst or a grasping or a desire for our experience to be different from the way it is in any given moment. We don't like what we are currently experiencing, we want something else. So there we put this wedge, you know. And we don't just tap the wedge in gently either, right? We use sledgehammers, you know. I don't like this. And mostly we're not consciously aware that we're doing that, right? That's the thing. We don't know that we're doing it. And we receive this pattern from our parents and our teachers and our society, of course, and our humanness for some reason. The Buddha said this suffering goes back to the limitless past, so don't try to figure out when it started, you know. Maybe he would have put psychology out of work, I don't know. So the path here is not, in that case, fixing up ourselves or fixing up our circumstances. But see if we can get that wedge out of there, you know. Let it slip out, relax enough that it just kind of goes. Maybe it slips out slowly, maybe it pops out in a rush, you know, or some of both. And settling into the things as they are. So we use the word acceptance, but acceptance is too small, I think. Acceptance implies that there's a possibility of non-acceptance. Merging, being with, so many words we could use, you know. Being in tune with the empty nature of all that is, you know, lofty words. And in the end, it can't be described with words anyway. There's a feeling to it, as you know, as you've experienced. And Keizan seems to be saying over and over what we've heard in many sources. The path is through quiet, you know, through stillness. But even that isn't quite right, because it's a quiet and a stillness that includes words, it includes motion, it includes the dynamic functioning of the whole universe, you know. It's not pushing the pause button on the whole world. But it's something like feeling the stillness in the middle of our insanity. Tuning in, settling into it. So I'm fond of settling. This is all translated from archaic Japanese into English, and our translator, who's also William Bodiford, actually. We're on a big William Bodiford kick right now. He's a wonderful guy. I haven't met him in person, but I have friends who have met him. Works in Florida International University. Anyway, he used the translation for some of Keizan's work as abiding, which is also good. Maybe he was thinking of the dude abides. But let's play with settling. I think settling is good for us. Good for us is a core orientation. How can there be more settling? So in formal zazen, of course, we have a particular format and method to invite settling. We set ourselves up carefully, try to align the body. I was mentioning how helpful I'm finding it to just bring my elbows out at the beginning and Rotate the upper arms out and let the shoulders drop and the chest open a little bit, and then lower my hands to the mudra. And a friend actually just told me, think about lifting slightly in the roof of your mouth, which is different from the usual string in the back of the head instruction. Found that interesting. And then when you do that, sometimes you're adding a little tension. You're like, right, yeah, I'm going to do it right. And at least I do. You know. Then that conscious effort to be like, okay, settling. This isn't about rigiding. This isn't about tightening. But it helps if we're lined up and open, right? It helps so much. Because the settling is not an idea in our head. It's an embodied experience, you know? And a wonderful metaphor for all this, which I think is actually pretty old, but it also shows up now in kids' books about meditation, which makes me think about one of my favorite things about the few years that I taught elementary school and trained to teach elementary school, is it gave me an excuse to read a whole bunch of kids' books. For a couple of years there, I was really up to date on children's literature. It was really cool. Now I'm out of date. But anyway, so I was thinking of the wonderful story, I forget the title. I think it might be called Moody Cow Meditates. Moody Cow was having a really bad day, you know. And his friend, I forget her name, this little girl teaches him about meditation and shows him this metaphor so we can follow in the footsteps of our great ancestor, Moody Cow. And picture a jar of muddy water. And it's murky, you know, you can't see through it. And we like clarity. We don't need Kazon to tell us that clarity is something we appreciate. We all like clarity. Sometimes it's been so long since we've had clarity, it's like a dim memory, you know. And clarity is not an all or nothing proposition, right? There are relative degrees of clarity and murk, you know. What do they call that? How far you can see. Or under the water or in the air, you know. But what do we tend to do with our jar full of muddy water, which we wish were clear? Shake it, right? You know? We run around, we're trying to solve all these things and fix ourselves and fix everybody else. And maybe a lot of time, part of what we're trying to do is get everyone else to be the way we think they should be so that we think we'll be happy because we've hooked our happiness on them, you know, and so on. And does this lead to clarity in a jar of muddy water? No, of course not. Just keeps shaking up the water. More stirred up, swirling, you know. So the answer is pretty obvious. We want clarity, and we need to let the mud settle to the bottom of the jar. In an earlier paragraph, Kazon talked about we can be like clear water, which originally has neither front nor back, so therefore you can see through it. And we can experience what he called the empty space, not bound by inside or outside. So we need to stop moving. We need to be still. And it takes time, right? It takes a long time. So I'm really grateful that we're trying the 7-day Sesshin online, and couldn't have done it if people didn't show up, so thank you. And it's been wonderful the last couple of days getting to speak with a few people in Doksan and hearing how powerful this practice is, you know, and I want to say even in this format, like it was a lesser something, which maybe is what we were thinking about when COVID hit, and we're like, okay, practice on Zoom, all right, but I don't think so anymore. I don't think it's a lesser format. I think it's just different, and that Zazen is bigger and less, like more unconditioned, you know, like completely unconditioned, really. Zazen doesn't require a beautiful Zendo, you know. I mean, I hope we get one again. It's a wonderful support, but it's not required. Because it seems to be working, which is an air quote, working really well in the ways, exactly the way it needs to in all of our homes, as far as I can tell so far. Maybe your experience does not feel that way. I don't know. Because we're having a whole different kind of sesshin, you know. Zazen is working in this setting. integrated with our homes and our daily lives and the stuff we have to do, or being drawn to the stuff we think we have to do that we don't have to do. Kind of helpful to have it sitting there. I did a retreat in the mindfulness format, but same kind of schedule, in the summer, or the fall, I guess, in the fall, yeah. And one person said to me, "I gotta stop cleaning my house." Like, what do you mean? She said, "Well, we have these open periods in the afternoon, and every time I'm thinking about going on a walk or taking a nap or maybe some inspiring reading, and I look in one corner, I say, oh my gosh. And next thing I know, the vacuum's out, the brooms are out, I'm scrubbing, you know." And then I mentioned that in a talk, and later three other people came to me in the interviews and said, "Oh, I'm so glad you said that. I'm going to stop cleaning my house too." Clean house is nice, but is that clarity, or is that just stirring the jar? So here we are, getting to integrate significant periods of Zen, formal Zen training, Zazen, Kinhin, service, talks, you know, right here, right wherever you're sitting, in your living room, in your bedroom, you know. And there are ways that that's helpful, that going off to the beautiful retreat center and thinking that the lovely Zendo is where it all happens is not so helpful, actually, if we associate our practice only with that. We forget that Zazen is not about a place. It's everywhere. So we stop and we let the mud settle. But there's one way that the muddy water jar metaphor doesn't work, actually, which is that a regular jar of muddy water, we could just stick on the shelf, right? And then go run errands. And we come back and say, "Oh, good, that's done. Clear water. Next." So this kind of internal muddy jar doesn't work that way. You can't just put it on the shelf and stay busy. Somehow always is responding to your vibration. So even though it's on the shelf, it's just like, "Aah!" And somehow this jar of muddy water requires you to be really present with the jar. You have to be gazing gently at the jar, merging with the jar, because you need to remember you are the jar. You are the jar. And this jar doesn't settle just by sitting there and spacing out. This jar settles when we attend to it openly, kindly, spaciously, when we enter and merge with it and practice with it and are in it, you know, and can notice more swirling, less swirling. Can we control this process? Not particularly. But we can show up, and we can allow, and we can invite settling. So let's play with that, not just in Zazen, right? But this afternoon and the meal breaks and evenings, right? These are powerful, powerful practice opportunities, not to be dismissed or spaced out through, you know. What's the way of being settled now as I wash the dishes, as I cook, as I talk to my spouse, as I go on a walk in the neighborhood? What's settled now? And it doesn't mean we should, you know, immobilize ourselves in full lotus and not move. You know, that would be too good for our legs and knees, you know. Zazen does not depend on sitting either, oddly enough. The jar can settle as we're walking, standing, lying down, writing an essential email, and then the jar continues settling if then you leave the computer and don't check the news. There's a reason why I give that kind of example, and it's not because I'm perfect at this. So the next three paragraphs of Zazen Yojinki, let's appreciate those and then we'll wrap it up. After like a couple page or so, we may be a page and a half in now, out of six. After a page or so of this subtle philosophical writing that we've been appreciating, he gets practical. And usually I notice when I read that, then my attention perks up like, oh good, I can understand this stuff. And I can argue with it too if I want to, you know. because now it's practical. It's in the realm that I can manipulate, right? Which is like the jar starts moving. You're like, oh, right, right, right. So let's listen to this practical advice from Kazon with the spirit of stillness. Therefore, you must not be involved in arts and crafts or healing and divination. Furthermore, song, dance, music, debate, and rhetoric, as well as the pursuit of fame and fortune, must be completely avoided. Although eulogy and lyrical poetry can contribute to calming the mind, you must not indulge in writing them. The renunciation of literature and calligraphy is a priority for seekers of the way, and is the most effective means of regulating the mind. Do not wear clothing that is either elegant or tattered. Fine clothes give rise to greed, as well as the fear of being robbed, and this becomes an obstacle to the pursuit of the way. To refuse clothes if offered as alms has always been a praiseworthy practice since ancient times. Even if you already own such clothes, do not indulge in wearing them. This is the tattered clothes. If thieves came to steal the clothes, do not bother to chase after them or regret the loss. You should wear old clothes that have been washed and mended till completely clean. If you do not clean and mend the clothes, you will get cold and sick, and that is also an obstacle to the pursuit of the way. Although we should not be overly concerned with physical conditions, the lack of food, clothing, and shelter. Although we should not be overly concerned with physical conditions, the lack of food, clothing, and shelter is known as the three insufficiencies, all of which are obstructive conditions. Do not eat food that is either raw or tough, stale or spoiled, for intestinal rumbling is a discomfort to the body and mind and an obstacle to zazen. But do not indulge in eating fine food. That is not only an obstruction for the body and mind, but indicates that you have not overcome greed. Eat enough food to maintain your vitality, but do not relish it. You try to sit in meditation after having eaten until you are too full, it can cause illness. Do not attempt meditation immediately after a large or small meal. You must wait a while to be ready to sit. Generally, mendicants and monks should eat sparingly. That means they should limit their portions, for example, eating two parts of three and leaving the rest. The usual medicinal foods, such as sesame and yams, should be eaten. This is an effective means of regulating the body. That's a lot of details. And isn't it interesting the way the mind wants to kind of grab on all those details? And would I read that again? No, we don't need all those details. But let's hear it, I think, more in the spirit, I think, that it was intended. Because our situation may be different in 21st century America than 14th century Japan. As encouragement, you know, to also pay attention to how we're living. How are we eating, dressing, sheltering ourselves? What activities are we choosing? And of course, you know, Kazon's day, they didn't have violent video games, you know, so the exciting things he's talking about are like, you know, singing, you know, so we can adjust accordingly. I love to sing, you know. I love music and dance. I really love calligraphy. I would not want to give that up. I'm not really doing any of those things during Sesshin. It's okay to not take the details literally, but really listen for the, you know, as best you can. And sometimes that doesn't mean include challenging yourself a little bit, not just to be like, yeah, well, that's an ancient thing from a different culture, so I still can do whatever the heck I want, right? That's not it either, you know. That's not it either. We may need to challenge ourselves a little bit to release from some things. We don't really practice this very much here, but it's a deep and wonderful practice to renounce things, you know. Say for this month or this year, right, for Lent, for Ramadan, for practice period, I'm not going to do X, Y, or Z, you know, whatever that might be for you. Maybe you have a moderate and controlled, reasonable alcohol relationship and you give it up, you know. Who knows what it might be? We have so many things. A lot of them involve screens now. So how do we live? How do we live in a way that's supportive of settling, that is settling, and not just like so that we can do meditation later to settle, right? That's a mistake. Zazen is happening. The jar is being stirred or allowed to settle all the time. What activities and choices and material relationships. All this stuff about clothing is interesting. A long paragraph just about clothes, you know, fascinating. I guess we don't worry too much about somebody knocking us over and stripping the clothes off our back if we wear our best outfit as much as they must have been then. Not so many stores. And by the way, that last little bit about medicinal foods, the usual medicinal foods such as sesame and yams should be eaten, an effective means of regulating the body. That's probably referring to dinner, which is called medicine in Mahayana Buddhism, because they wanted to be respectful of the earlier Buddhists who, that's like one of the Buddha's first instructions, don't eat after noon. It was his way of really encouraging a very simple lifestyle. When you went out begging in the morning, got a pretty good amount of food. It was one big old meal, big bowl, begging bowls like this big. And then you eat the one meal midday. You don't eat again after that so that you're freed up, you know? You don't have to do anything but practice. But Buddhism in China and Japan and the northern countries, either because of the climate being colder or just cultural differences, I don't know which, they still ate in the evening. But they ate simpler meals. That's why in Oryoki we just use the two bowls and don't chant. And it wasn't called dinner or even meal. Or even food. It was called medicine. Because the Buddha told the monks in the beginning days, one meal a day, but if you need to eat, if you need to take some medicine in the evening, that's okay. So that's our medicine. So I'm really psyched. I have a yam in the fridge. I don't usually have a yam in the fridge. I'm going to eat that for dinner and be in accord with this practice. I guess I better sprinkle some sesame seeds on it too. So sesame and yams is your medicine tonight. If you want to follow that literally. But of course, it's not about literal. So, thank you, Keizan Zenji. We'll keep practicing. Sitting, walking, eating, all of it. Join through our little screens, which does connect us, for real. And really kind of settling more, I think, into this sense of continuity, continuous practice. Suzuki Roshi was really good about talking about this aspect of the practice, its continuousness, its endlessness. That's why he got into stuff like freaking people out by saying, no gaining idea, you're not going to get anything. Whoa! But they love Suzuki Roshi. They said, okay. They must have privately or at some subliminal level all be going, whoa, why are we doing this, you know? But they set that aside and practiced anyway, the early students. I've talked a lot before about the culture of those days, which I've heard so much about from people who were there, and they were pretty enthusiastic. Maybe a little shade of cultish, you know? A little shade of that, probably. Hopefully they won't be offended if I say that in a Dharma talk. So I thought, well, let's hear from Suzuki Roshi before we go. Here's a few paragraphs from Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, kind of about all this. Always Suzuki Roshi encouraging a broad, wide open understanding of continuous practice. Here's Suzuki Roshi. Because Buddha was the founder of the teaching, people tentatively call his teaching Buddhism. But actually, Buddhism is not some particular teaching. Buddhism is just truth, which includes various truths in it. Zazen practice is the practice that includes the various activities of life. So actually, we do not emphasize the sitting posture alone. How to sit is how to act. We study how to act by sitting, and this is the most basic activity for us. This is why we practice Zazen in this way. Even though we practice Zazen, we should not call ourselves the Zen school. We should just practice Zazen, taking our example from the Buddha. That is why we practice. Buddha taught us how to act through our practice. That is why we sit. To To do something, to live in each moment, means to be the temporal activity of Buddha. To sit in this way is to be Buddha, to be as the historical Buddha was. The same thing applies to everything we do. Everything is Buddha's activity. So whatever you do, or even if you keep from doing something, Buddha is in the activity. Because people have no such understanding of Buddha, they think that what they do is the most important thing, without knowing who is actually doing it. People think they're doing various things, but actually Buddha is doing everything. Each of us has our own name, but those names are really the many names of one Buddha. Each one of us has many activities, but those activities are all Buddha's activities. Without knowing this, people put emphasis on some activity or another, and when they put that kind of emphasis on Zazen, it's not true Zazen. It looks as if they're sitting the way Buddha sat, but there's a big difference in their understanding. They understand the sitting posture as just one of the four basic postures, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, and they think, I now take this posture. But Zazen is all the postures. Every posture is Buddha's posture. This understanding is the right understanding of Zazen. If you practice in this way, it is Buddhism. It is truth. This is a very important point. So I admit, when I first read that, I was a little like, yeah, whatever. But somehow this is Shane, this way, right? We can appreciate that teaching a little more deeply, I think. Feel a little closer to understanding our activity as Buddha's activity. Okay? I'd say carry on, but who carries on? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Okay, how about we'll just do a bow to end the talk, and then we'll stand up and do our three prostrations as the beginning of noon service with Talis leading us. I'll do an incense offering too, Talis. You'll be able to see. I'll do the pinning thing. Okay, so let's prepare for noon service, Metta Sutta. I'm excited about playing a little more with the Doshi stuff. It's fun. Oops.